Larry, let's start with this new article in Financial Times. It says that the ammunition and the weapons sent to Ukraine, these ammunition were bought by the Czech Republic, and they sent them to Ukraine. It seems to be their term to be of poor quality. How do you find the current situation of the Ukrainian army?
Well, look, let's start with this concept of ammunitions of poor quality. It either works or it doesn't, okay? That's the nice thing about all firearms, whether we're talking cartridges that go in semi-automatic pistols, handguns, or artillery shells that go in large howitzers. When you pull the trigger or jerk the string, and it's supposed to go bang, sometimes a big bang. When you do that and you get click, no bang, that's called a misfire. Well, that means there is a problem with that ammunition. There was no quality control. They didn't ensure that there was enough gunpowder, for example, loaded into the shell casing. All of these have some sort of primer or something that it initiates the detonation. And if you don't, you know, if you don't take care to make sure that you're putting in the right kind of gunpowder, it's not going to go off. Well, you get what you pay for. And, you know, Ukraine has become such a grift that people are getting contracts and supplying crap, and there's no accountability. And, you know, nobody gets punished for it. Nobody gets held accountable. Nobody gets indicted. So that brings us back to your question about, well, how's that Ukrainian army doing? Not well. There's a video online on Telegram channels of one guy who surrendered, a Ukrainian surrendered to the Russians. And he's telling them, he says, you know, basically, last week I was in Kiev and I'm coming out of a bakery and I got jumped and thrown into a van, taken to a high school, a gym, and we were held there for 3 days, given, you know, new clothes, this army outfit, and outfitted with weapons. And then we were sent here. He goes, I didn't know where I am. That's the Ukrainian army now. You know, they've got a few experienced fighters, and they've got some people that know what they're doing, but they are increasingly having the ranks filled with people who have no training and or who lack the appropriate training. You know, those are, you know, two key things. So it's, you know, I had said earlier, I guess in April, that I thought Ukraine, this thing could be over by end of June. And I still stand by that now, in light of what we're seeing, that the collapse could come that soon. They might be able to hang on till August. I think that's questionable because, and number one, you've got the Russians have or it looks like they're putting 800,000, almost a million men on that front. And the front is being extended by another, you know, 400 kilometers, 220 miles, I guess. Ukraine doesn't have the manpower to deal with it. And apart from the manpower, just some of the Telegram channel videos over the last several days are showing the Russians blowing up M777 howitzers, Bradley fighting vehicles, tanks, both M1s and Leopards. Now, they're getting destroyed at a tremendous rate, and then on, you know, on top of that, there's also a CNN interview with the Ukrainian tank crew, and these guys are saying, and they've got an M1 Abrams, and they're basically saying it's a piece of junk. It doesn't offer the proper protection. It's already broken down. We just got out here and it's broken down because it got too much moisture in the capacitor, you know, whatever. So this would be funny, like an absurd Monty Python skit, if it wasn't for the fact that there are actually people dying because of this madness.
We've learned that Macron is trying to make a coalition in the European Union to train Ukrainians. When you see Boris Johnson inviting Azov Battalion to the United Kingdom and calling them heroes, and right now Macron is trying to do something so radical, and you see the president of Estonia saying that we are going to bring Russia to its knees. Do you think it's part of the propaganda machine that they're doing? What they're doing, in your opinion?
They are. Are you familiar with the character Walter Mitty? So Walter Mitty was this, cartoon character who always had these terrific fantasies about, I'm the king of the world. I'm the world's best basketball player. I'm the wealthiest banker. He'd always indulge these fantasies. Meanwhile, he was some guy maybe serving ice cream up at from a street cart. You know, that was his reality. That's what Macron and Estonia and these guys are. They're going to, quote, train the Ukrainians to do what? I mean, what is their expertise? The last war the French won was World War I. Could we count that? They sort of won it. They, with the help, they got by with a little help from their friends in the United States and the UK. That's the last one they won over 100 years ago. They didn't win World War II. That was won largely by Russia. And then the retaking of France was done by the Brits and the Americans, not the French, even though de Gaulle got to ride at the head of the parade. Vietnam, they got their ass kicked. They got destroyed at Dien Bien Phu. So my point is, if you're going to go, like I'm a firearms instructor, and I can say, okay, hey, I'm going to train you, Nima, but you watch me shoot and you see that I can't even hit a target, and you see that I keep pointing the gun at myself, why would you want training from me? I have not demonstrated competence and excellence in all phases of that discipline. France hasn't displayed any competence or discipline. And I know, I've seen some of the comments from the Francophiles, the lovers of France. And France once was a great country to visit. But, come on, people. You can live in the glories of the past, but, Napoleon's been dead now, over 200 and, 50 years. So let's not start pretending that you've got the equivalent of Napoleon back. There's nothing that, in fact, the Ukrainians should be training the French. I mean, if here's the business deal, if I was Zelensky, I'd be renting out my officers to send to NATO to teach them how to fight in a modern war, because at least they've had the experience. They've been out there on the ground. And what I'm saying for France applies to NATO, America as well. I mean, boy, we sure beat those Panamanians, when we invaded back in 1989, 1990. We're a bully. I mean, my American colleagues don't like to hear that, but how else do you describe it? We keep beating up on these weaker countries that don't have, peer military, that don't have the kind of array of weaponry and technological capabilities that we do. And even then we struggle, as we did in Iraq, as we did in Afghanistan. And so the situation on the ground, I guess the problem is there's nobody in leadership in the West that actually can get their brain around what's going on. Or maybe they do, and they're just in denial. And so, you're going to lie to everybody about what's going on, just do political spin. There comes a point when you can't spin this away, because just like, Baghdad Bob in the early days of the U.S. invasion back in 2003. There are no American tanks. No American tanks here. No. And in the background, here come the tanks, That's what it's going to be like in Ukraine. The Russians are going to eventually overrun. The lines of the Ukrainian soldiers are going to break. They do not have, it's not like they've got entrenched, well-fortified defensive positions that they can fall back into now. Those have been wiped out. Now they're trying to fall back into hastily dug trenches, and the activity by Russia with drones has escalated dramatically. And then on top of that, the fab bombs, you know, the glide bombs that are being dropped, the artillery, the number of shells that Russia's producing is, you know, the United States can't compete in any of these areas. And the United States and Europe, period. So the short assessment, the Ukrainians are, they're done.
Yeah, you've mentioned the production of artillery and ammunition by Russians. That Putin, his latest report on this production, he said in some areas they're producing more than 22 times than they have been producing before this conflict started.
Yeah.
And in 22 times, 15 times in some areas. And at the same time, we're hearing that in the mainstream media in the West, they're talking about that Russia outproduces the whole West by 3 times. Do you think it's accurate to say three times or more than that?
No, it's absolutely accurate. There's a, you know, the problem in the West is the West basically hollowed itself out. When your industrial corporations, the ones that build factories and that produce things, two things happened. One, they became more financialized, interested in the finances of it, the bottom line, you know, the price of stock, how does it look for the shareholders, as opposed to saying, hey, we want to make sure that we have a capability to produce these systems here in the United States. So, you know, like right now, there are pictures, I think in the Wall Street Journal, they're building a new factory in Texas to produce artillery shells. Where's all the equipment coming from? Turkey. Who are the guys on the ground supervising, putting the equipment together? Turks. You go, wait a second. This used to, you know, America used to be, you know, standing proud. You know, we had General Motors, we had Ford, we were the leader. And we're not the leader anymore because those corporations in pursuit of better stock prices shipped a lot of the industrial production overseas because you got cheaper labor. And you didn't have to worry as much about labor unions. So you could pay people less. You didn't have to worry about health care. You could basically exploit the workers. But boy, your shareholders were getting a big return at home. So that's one of the things that happened. And in conjunction with that, then you had government regulation across the board, make it more costly for an industrial facility to stay working, stay functioning. So a combination of those two factors have led to just a evisceration of America's industrial capability. Yeah, we've still got some. We're not completely denuded. But Russia never went through that. Russia's factories for producing steel and aluminum and processing minerals of all sorts, that remained intact. They didn't say, oh, well, you know, because we're so preoccupied with wanting to have reduced carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we're going to eliminate these plants. They didn't go through that nonsense. So now all they had to do is find workers and bring in, you know, I understand they are bringing in even some workers from Africa to work the plants. All right. Those people are going to get, they're going to earn good money. The Russians at least provide them health care, which is something that a lot of the factory workers that work in, let's call them U.S.-owned factories that are based overseas, probably don't get. So it's just, you know, Russia's got it across the board. That's the one thing. You know, I was saying this from the outset. You know, I was writing about this 2 years ago, being told I was crazy. Well, look who's talking now. Because the fact of the matter was the West, I'm not sure if it was the intelligence community or just the leadership didn't listen to the intelligence community, but they failed to take into account Russia's status as both the number one country in terms of natural resources, and then the fact that it had the ability to process and use those resources internally. They didn't have to sell them to somebody else in order to realize an economic gain out of them. They had their own at-home ability.
Do you think if they start right now, as you mentioned, in Texas, they're trying to make more ammunition, how long does it take for the United States to get back on the track?
No, it's not going to get back on the track. Maybe a year and a half from now, that factory in Texas might be turning out, 30,000 shells a month. Russia's doing 100,000 right now, I think. Do the math. They just done, the West is not going to catch up. There is one way they could. We would have to completely mobilize the population, impose severe economic restrictions on certain activities, and insist that all of the resources go to war production. We could do that. There'd be a revolt. There'd be an uprising. The American people wouldn't stand for it. So, that's why I say it's not going to happen. It's a pipe dream.
If Russia makes a strategic breakthrough in eastern Ukraine, the Baltic states and Poland will deploy troops on Ukrainian territory, according to Spiegel, Der Spiegel, Germany.
Yeah.
Do you see any reality in this type of reporting? Because how are they going to do that? How trained are they? How serious is this decision, in your opinion?
Yeah, it's delusional. Do you know anything about dogs? You know what a Rottweiler is? So a Rottweiler, I've got two of them. Great dogs, very loving, but they're big. I've been about 130 pounds each, well over 200 kilograms. And they've got a ferocious bark, and they're extremely strong, very strong. That's Russia. Then have you seen any of these Chihuahuas? These little bitty, tiny, skinny, yappy dogs. All they do is yap, 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 yap. They are a pain in the ass. That's Estonia. That's Latvia. That's Lithuania. So I let my dogs out. Those dogs can come out and yap all they want. My dogs will eat them. Russia would eat Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania if they dared to do something like that. Yeah, they've got some troops, but so what? Again, let's go back to France. What's the last war that Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania won? Where are their troops so combat trained and combined arms? Oh, they're not. Oh, they participated in a NATO exercise. Oh, that's great. That qualifies you. And it doesn't. I'm just being sarcastic. So, this kind of talk is delusional on the part of these people, because they're not coming to grips with reality. If Russia wanted to, yes, it could attack those countries and destroy those people. That's not what Russia's about, and that's not what Russia. Was there a time? In fact, even when the Soviets were occupying those countries, they did it for one reason. They wanted a buffer. The Soviets wanted a buffer because, from after 1945, they looked back. They'd been invaded 1941. They'd been invaded 1918. They'd been invaded in 1854, was it, with Crimea. They'd been, after you keep getting invaded for a while, you say, okay, wait a second. This West will not leave us alone. We're going to create a buffer. And that's really that's what Putin's all about right now. That they've recognized, there's no coexistence with the West, at least in its current leadership form. When you got nitwits like Rishi Sunak, he's like mini-me, a skinny mini-me from, one of these, cult movies. He's just, he's a nobody. He looks like a little boy. They got dressed up to go out and, you know, play banker. You know, he's just a tiny man, and he's tiny both in physical stature and mental stature as well. So it's just it's dangerous when you have this kind of these Lilliputians running around trying to tie down Goliath. Not going to happen.
The other thing, Larry, would be the nature of the wars that NATO has been involved in all these years. It's totally different from what we're witnessing right now in Ukraine. Even they have been trained by NATO. Right now in Ukraine is something totally different from what they have been experiencing so far.
Yeah. I mean, this, you know, when you look at the, and really these were not quote wars. Remember, Nima, these weren't wars because U.S. Congress didn't declare war. These are police actions. You know, they call a police action. Stop right there. I'll read you your rights. So, you know, yeah, the United States could pour in men and materiel. And even, you know, we found out with our tanks and armored personnel vehicles that were deployed in Afghanistan, as an example. Man, they look great. They're expensive to maintain. You don't want to be standing in front of one when it's coming at you. But it turned out that there was limited use. A lot of those tanks and vehicles couldn't go up and down certain mountain roads. They'd get stuck. And then they'd get out there, they'd break down. And it's not like you've got the repair center just, you know, down the road, you know, a mile or so, and you could push it in. Eh, it needs to be fixed. So people forget that when you put a weapon into somebody's hands and you're going to ask them to try to kill and destroy someone else or to take control of territory and keep the other people out, well, by putting that weapon in their hand, you're presupposing they know how to use it. And not only knowing how to use it, but they can use it accurately and efficiently, and that they've got all the ammunition they need in order to operate it, and that they've got sufficient food and water, particularly if it's extremely hot. You know, you sweat out real quick, and if you don't replace the water, you're going to be down with heat exhaustion or possibly dead. There's limits what you can carry in terms of physical weight on your body. And if you're having if you've got 70 pounds of gear on your back, and you're marching up a mountain at 9,000 feet, you know, unless you grew up in that region and did that on a daily basis, no, I don't care how great of an athlete you are, you're going to collapse. You can't sustain it. And then the communications, you know, once you're going to tell somebody, hey, go here and do X, Y, and Z, but all of a sudden you get new information where it's changed and they're going to walk into a trap. Well, how do you communicate with them? Say, oh, don't do that, come back. So you got to have the protocols for the communications, and you want to make sure that those communications are. So I'm going into the, you got layer upon layer upon layer of logistics, of planning, of organization that, you know, the United States simply has not been prepared for in terms of a peer-to-peer battle. We struggled with this in Afghanistan. We struggled with it in Iraq. And those, it's not, you know, we didn't come out as winners, whatever, you know. And people say, well, how do you define victory? Okay, I define victory in Afghanistan as an example, in which the elected, that the people that have been put in charge and are now leading the country are fully friendly with the United States, welcome the United States in, and are observing a rule of law, and are not subjecting themselves to corruption, you know, sort of they're acting in a way that we don't act in the United States, of course, but where we have the corruption and no rule of law. But we didn't get that. We got run out because, number one, we didn't want to lose troops, you know, and we didn't lose a lot of people in Afghanistan. That's true. But the reason for that is the political leaders, both Republican and Democrat, both George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and then Donald Trump, they understood Americans have no stomach for seeing it's men, mostly men, but the few women that serve as well, killed in meaningless combat actions in Afghanistan. So that's the other aspect to this. You've got to have the political will. Do you view this as an existential threat? Is this a fight to the death for you? Then okay, fine. You're gonna be willing to risk your life for it. But if that's not the perception, that it's not a fight to the death, then we're looking at other issues.
They're talking about that before this year comes to an end, they're gonna have huge losses on the territory. And in your opinion, they're talking about Odessa, Nikolaev, these cities, or they're talking about something else?
Yeah, no, that's what they're talking about. Kiev, I think they'll lose Kiev. They're going to lose Odessa and Mykolaiv. This front, I saw a map yesterday. And if you look at it, it was done by a Swiss military officer. He was briefing the front. And basically, you got like seven different army groups spread out along the front now. Seven, maybe it's up to eight. And so they are, as they're pressing forward, it's forcing Ukraine to push reserves to those lines to try to stop it, except they don't have reserves. So the people that are trying to stop these Russian advances are outgunned and outnumbered. So at some point, that's going to break. And when it breaks, like I said, they don't have a position, a good solidified protected position they can fall back to and say, okay, now if you saw that movie Lord of the Rings, and when the King of Rohan took all of his people to that fortress and back into the caves, that's the Ukrainians. They're going to be going back, locking themselves in the caves, and here come the orcs, because that's what they call the Russians. But they don't have that. So yeah, Odessa is going to fall, and Kiev up. Russia will be in full control of 40% of Ukraine, the land that exists east of the Dnieper River.
If Russia doesn't capture Odessa and just leave it in the hand of Ukrainians, that would be dangerous for the future, for anything happening in that region, because they can use Odessa to attack Crimea easily. And how do you see this concept?
Well, number one, this the population of Odessa is largely Russian speaking, and that has, that's been a long-standing Russian city, not a Ukrainian city. The only reason it would wind up in Ukraine was because Nikita Khrushchev, who was born in Kiev, decided to, quote, gift it to Ukraine when he was premier. So, it was, again, it was an arbitrary decision. The Russians are not going to leave Ukraine intact as a military in any form or fashion. They are going to be crushed and destroyed. They're not going to compromise. They're not going to say, oh, okay, we didn't mean it. Well, yeah, you can keep your tanks and artillery shells and drones so you can attack us. Yeah, that's fine. No. The Russians, they reached a point that, they may have been at that position to negotiate something like that 2 years ago. Not now, not given what's transpired. And especially given, this talk about trying to strike deep inside Russia. They're limited what they can do, even if they got a Taurus missile. Because from the point of wherever that missile's launched, it can travel a maximum of 300 miles. And the Russians have proved increasingly adept at using electronic warfare to jam and affect the guidance systems on those missiles.
Putin was mentioning this for the first time. I saw that he was directly talking about this issue. He said that if they attack something inside Russia, there would be some serious consequences for them.
Yeah, I didn't quite understand his formulation on that, because they've already attacking inside Russia. All right, they've been hitting Belgorod for, you know, well over a year. So, and they've launched a couple of strikes in Moscow and in some other cities. So, you know, they've done it. They've crossed that red line. So what's Russia going to do about it now? I think he may be, again, he was putting out a warning yesterday. I up to now, he's never made such an explicit threat. But now he's made that threat and made it very clear. So if these attacks continue, then I anticipate we're going to see stepped up hypersonic missile attacks on all remaining infrastructure in Ukraine and military facilities, number one. But there also could be attacks launched against any facilities outside of Ukraine, in Poland, Romania, that are being used to provide supplies to Ukraine to fight the war, including drones, etc.
Yeah. How do you see the situation right now between the United States and China? Recently, Michael McCall was talking about that. The United States has already sent weapons to Taiwan, but Michael McCall said that we, unlike Ukraine, we are sending the latest generations of weapons to Taiwan. They're admitting that what they have been sending to Ukraine so far. It's so amazing to admit that.
But that they're sending old weapons, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And right now he's saying that, no, for the case of Taiwan, it's totally different. We're going to say send the latest versions of these weapons to Taiwan, and we're getting ready to fight China. How do you see these new escalations between the United States and China, and why they're doing this right now in the middle of the conflict with Ukraine? Because anybody who has some sort of logic in his mind says that when you are at war with Russia, you cannot have another front with China. That would be devastating for the West.
Yes, it's called not being able to fight a two-front war. I got fired as a Fox News talking head, not fired per se, but they stopped putting me on air back in 2002, because I went on air and said that the United States then was contemplating going into Iraq. And I said, we couldn't fight a two-front war. We're already involved with Afghanistan. We're going to go into Iraq. Well, look how small those conflicts are compared to fighting China and fighting Russia. Are you kidding me? The U.S. Army's, we've talked about this before, you know, under less than 500,000 men in active duty strength. The Navy ships, they're vulnerable to hypersonic missiles, which the Chinese have. So how exactly are we going to, quote, fight Chinese? Oh, I know. We'll use our F-35s. Yeah, they just, a new one was being sent out to California the other day, took off from Albuquerque Air Force Base, blew up, crashed on takeoff. Hey, that's only $110 million down the toilet right there. You know, this is crazy talk, but it also ignores what the United States has previously promised China. 1979, during the presidency of Jimmy Carter, yeah, I think the United States signed a declaration with the Chinese affirming that we would not supply weapons to Taiwan. That's what we said. That was our promise. Now you know what to make of U.S. promises. They're worthless. The U.S. agreed with the Chinese after the visit of Richard Nixon in 72. We believed we accepted the one China policy, that Taiwan is part of China. Now we're trying to claim that it's not, and that we're going to fight the China. We don't have the ability to fight the Chinese. We don't have the industrial base to fight the Chinese. We don't have the manpower to fight the Chinese. We don't have the Navy to fight the Chinese. I mean, we are seriously deluded. We keep looking in the mirror and, you know, say, oh, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? I am, you know, I'm fabulous, you know, that kind of thing. And we're not. It's just, yeah, we've got a lot of expensive gear, and yeah, our troops can look really cool in some ninja gear. But if it comes down to an actual, you know, fight where people are dying, and you know, you're going to lose ships, you're going to lose planes, do you have the ability to replace those? No. The United States does not have the ability to replace what it loses. It takes, what, 5 years, 6 years to build an aircraft carrier? Hell, during World War II, they were building those things like in every 3 months. 3 to 6 months, they could turn out an aircraft carrier during World War II. Now, that's, you know, more than... really more than 4 years, I think. So this kind of madness by politicians like McCall, just crazy talk. And, but it does have, what it does do is the Russians hear it, the Chinese hear it, and they go, those Americans are crazy. So let's get ready to fight them. We're going to get ready to fight them. And the difference between them and the United States is they have the industrial capability to replace what they lose. We don't.
Yeah. To have a conflict in Ukraine, the United States and the West needed somebody, a Zelensky-type president in Ukraine to bring this conflict on, to start this fight with Russia. And here, when you look at Taiwan right now, do they have a Zelensky type president to start fighting China? Or they totally understand what's at stake for them if they start this?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like the current guy that they put in there, he's got a little bit of the Zelensky trait to him. You know, he's talking tough and looking to provoke China. So good luck with that. It didn't work out for Zelensky. It's not going to work out for him. You know, the West keeps hoping that China is going to launch a military strike on Taiwan. I don't think they will. They don't need to. All they have to do is wait. They can blockade Taiwan and, you know, compel its surrender if they want. But I think they're also sort of waiting to see what's going to happen politically in the United States. If they got to deal with Biden for another 4 years, I don't see how he survives 4 years, but that's another point. Then they recognize that there's definitely going to be conflict. With Trump, I think they recognize there's a potential to negotiate, to work out a deal. Even though Trump was saying, hey, if China invaded Taiwan, I'd bomb Beijing. Oh, you know, please. That's stupid too. God, why can't we get somebody with a measure of who's an adult and who's intelligent? Instead
who's
of saying
the target of this type
like
of
that?
Rhetoric, Larry, on the part of Donald Trump?
Say what?
Who's the target of this type of rhetoric on the part of Donald Trump?
Wealthy conservatives who, you know, believe that all we got to do is drop a few bombs and, you know, we'll Taiwan and Russia, they'll come around. I mean, the only reason they're doing that is because we haven't been tough enough. I've got several friends, you know, dear friends who were veterans of Vietnam. They fought in Vietnam. And I can't talk to them about this because they don't want to hear it. Because in their view, we just didn't get the support of Congress. That's why we lost. No, no, no. The Vietnamese were actually better equipped and more committed to winning than we were. And I'm not sure, you know, we killed so many Vietnamese. And to achieve what? We were really trying to protect the colonial interests of France when that whole thing started. Because Vietnam was a French colony. And that was why there were so many great French restaurants in Saigon back in the day, now Ho Chi Minh City. So this this notion that the Americans have that, oh, we could have done X, Y, and Z if only we would have put in enough troops, if only we would have blown up more stuff, if only, if only, if only, if only. It's the if only excuse. And, you know, no, there's actual, let's step back and look at it objectively. We do not have the ability to engage in a modern war and sustain it in terms of the logistics to keep it supplied, to continue to operate. We're going to run short. And we just got to come to grips with that and stop taking, you know, going to war as our first option. That's the thing that's so disturbing now about America. It's either sanctions or war. So much for negotiations.
How do you see the activities in Philippines, what they're doing there, the United States? Are they preparing for something? Are they, what's the reality in Philippines, in your opinion?
Yeah, we're going to use the Philippines as a proxy, just like we used Ukraine as a proxy to try to provoke China, and then you know, let the Filipinos die, and as we try to attack and weaken China, using the Filipinos as a wedge. That's it. That's what's going on. You know, same playbook.
The problem would be that the love that Chinese have for Taiwan doesn't exist for Philippines. They
can
crush the Philippines.
But yeah, but it's what they've got. Again, people keep talking about China wanting to crush this, China wanting to crush that. They're going to invade. Show me the history of China as an invading imperial force. And I'm not talking the last 200 years. I'm talking the last 1,000 years. China has not been loading up in boats and selling to Africa and buying slaves from African slave traders and then bringing them back. China has not been going around setting up colonial outposts in South America, Central America, Africa, and other parts of Asia. They've been pretty insular. Now, I mean, they've had all sorts of battles and struggles internally, yes. But, you know, we keep projecting China as this raving imperial power that's bent on conquering the world. I think it's just the United States engaged in psychological projection. We're the only ones keen on conquering the world and being in charge.
One of the questions that one of our audience wanted me to ask you is, the United States is forced to borrow approximately $8 trillion every 100 days. Is that what a strategic defeat looks like? Has the United States lost the war with China?
Well, which war? You know, so
the economic war.
No, hey, look, as long as the Chinese are stupid enough to lend us money, okay. Because that's what's going on. Whenever they buy U.S. Treasury bills, they're lending the United States money. So if I keep coming back to you, Nima, every week, say, hey, Nima, I need another $1,000, man. Can I have $1,000? And you keep giving it to me, and then I keep abusing you. I keep threatening, hey, I'm going to come over, I'm going to kick your ass. You know, I'm going to beat you up. I'm going to take your house. Hey, give me another $1,000. You know, at some point you go, whoa, I don't like this relationship. Yeah, I lend you money and you're in theory going to pay, you're paying me back with some interest, but maybe it's not worth that, the trouble. And see, that's one of the things that's happening now with BRICS. The rise of, you know, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, or community, where you're adding other countries like Iran, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, Thailand just indicated, hey, we want to be a part. So you're going to spread to the global south and create an alternative mechanism for funding international trade. Well, part of the power of the United States is that we've been able to convince the rest of the world, hey, you got to trade in dollars. If you don't trade in dollars, you can't trade. And while you're at it, buy some more of our treasury bonds, buy these bonds, lend us some more money so we can keep spending. And we got some inflation, but we don't ever, you know, you guys are the ones holding the bonds. You're the ones, if we go bankrupt, you know, you lose. And that's why I think you've seen China, you know, they haven't completely bailed out of the bond market, but they're certainly stocking up on gold like it's, you know, there's no tomorrow. I think that's telling. And so it's, you know, up to this point, the United States, because the dollar is the international reserve currency, it's the currency people need to use to buy oil and other goods in international commerce. As long as that system stays in place, the United States does have some power.
You know, Larry, what's so amazing in the recent years, we have been witnessing that in Brazil, if you want to buy something from China, we don't need dollar anymore. We have to buy it in Brazilian currency. The dollar is totally gone. And you just use the Brazilian currency and you don't have that effect of dollar going up and down influencing the price of products.
Yeah.
It's happening to each and every country sooner or later in the BRICS. That's pretty game changing.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's most of the people in the West haven't caught on to that yet. A few of the policymakers are starting to recognize it and go, whoa, wait a second. You know, you don't need our dollars anymore. So, and that's where, you know, China and Russia both recognize that, you know, this is not just a matter of beating the United States on the battlefield. It's a matter also of beating them in the banks. That, and that's one of the reasons you've seen the West, both the United States and the Europeans, on the one hand, you keep talking, yeah, we need to take that $300 billion of Russian assets that we've frozen, and we need to take that and give it to the Ukrainians. What's given them pause, what's preventing that from happening, is the adults that actually understand finance say, well, if you do that, then everybody who's thought that the US dollar was a safe currency to hold, we don't have to worry about our money being taken, all of a sudden now going to say our money's no longer safe. That if we have anything in any kind of bank associated with the United States, They can just steal our money. You're not gonna put your money someplace where somebody can steal it. And so all of a sudden at that point, people will start drawing large sums of money out. They'll go buy gold to put it into foreign bank accounts. And it'd be essentially like a run on the US dollar. So that's one of the things I think that prevented the West, despite all their tough talk. Oh yeah, we're gonna just take that money. You know, grow up, understand what you're saying, because it's going to backfire on you.
Just shifting the gear to conflict in Gaza and what's going on right now in Rafah, how do you find the pressures coming to Netanyahu and his administration from ICJ, from ICC, from European countries, from the United States? How do you see right now the conflict, and how do you see the situation in Rafah?
There was an American entrepreneur a few years ago named Dale Carnegie. And I think he wrote the book, How to Win Friends and Influence Enemies and Influence People. Netanyahu's writing the opposite book, How to Make Enemies and Lose Friends. So I think just today we learned that, so today's Thursday, Brazil has permanently withdrawn its ambassador from Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. I'm not sure where. I think the Brazilian embassy is in Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
Leaving the chargé, the deputy chief of mission, in charge. So downgrading, you know, okay, we're calling our ambassador back. Across the board, Turkey is condemning Israel as guilty of genocide. In the past, you know, it's still selling oil, but I don't know how much longer that's going to continue. They have broken off trade relations. The Israelis killed one or four Egyptian military officers there in Rafah, just across the border, what they call it, the Philadelphia corridor. Egypt has yet to respond to that, but I think the pressure is going to be significant to do so. So It's as if the Israelis are possessed of a demon that is inciting them to see how many Palestinians they can kill. Because it's just, the images are horrific. I was thinking today about publishing an article, and it was intended to be sarcastic at first. Yes, I title it, "Here Are the Photos of the 40 Babies Killed in That Terrorist Attack." And people think, oh, that's October 7th. But you're going to see, you're not going to see a single Israeli baby, because Hamas wasn't killing Israeli babies. But I can give you hundreds of images of Palestinian children. I mean, good God, there's one from just yesterday. This two-year-old is blown in half, literally blown in half. The lower half of her torso is missing. That's what Israel's doing. And these other, you know, the United States clearly is complicit in this. We're enabling Israel to do it. And the other Arab and Muslim nations in the area are still, they're talking, you know, they're talking but not doing. The Houthis, however, God bless them, or Allah bless them, they just shot down their sixth Predator drone. And they put a hole in another ship heading up the Red Sea. They, you know, they're pretty amazing. And the photo, there's actually a movie clip of these five guys standing on top of this Predator. I mean, one of them's barefoot and they're wearing sandals and holding up old guns. You know, a Predator drone's over $30 million piece of equipment, and it's lying there. They brought it down. So, the Israelis they're becoming more extreme in this regard. I mean, the notion that was a mistaken bombing of that tent camp the other day, please, that's a lie. I took the initial statistics off of the Israeli Foreign Ministry website, and one of my readers, a great guy who's when it wants to remain nameless, has put it in and start putting it into spreadsheets. So you get it into a spreadsheet where you get pivot tables and you can do all sorts of analysis. And what you, and I guess I really, even when I looked at the data the first time, I hadn't realized that well over 70% of the attacks and the casualties that have occurred in Israel from alleged Palestinian violence occurred in that five-year period, 2000 to 2005, during the what's known as the Second Intifada. After that, the number of attacks was very limited, and the majority took place in the West Bank, not Gaza. Only a third of the attacks involved bombs. The other two-thirds were rifles, rockets, car crashes, stabbings. You know, sort of a potpourri of everything. And the entire number of Israelis killed during 24 years of unrelenting Palestinian Hamas terrorism was 1,552. Well, good God, that's how many people get murdered in Chicago every year, almost. And we're talking 24 years. That's nothing. And then when you compare that with how many Palestinians are being killed by the Israelis, you know, that during that same 24-year period prior to October 7th, excess of 8,000. So over 2.5 times, almost 3 times as many Palestinians being killed by Israelis as Israelis being killed by Palestinians. So the facts are the facts. Not my numbers. Those are objective numbers. So the fact of the matter is, in terms of terrorist activity in Israel, Israel's the biggest terrorist. If you're measuring terrorism in terms of body counts. And now since the start of this the war, the October 7th, the number of Israelis killed by Hamas, we still don't have a firm number. Now, we do have an overall total number, which is like 1,150, I guess. But of that 1,150, we really don't know how many were actually killed by Hamas and killed by Israel. We do know that the Israelis bombed, you know, well over, you know, hundreds of vehicles. They hit him with rockets as they were fleeing the rave in the desert. They didn't know who was inside those cars. They didn't know if they're Israeli or Palestinian. So they blew them up anyway. I guarantee you at least, probably at least 200 Israelis died in that. We also have eyewitness testimony from some of the kibbutzim where Israeli tanks fired on houses with Israeli hostages inside and killed the hostages. So as I said, we're not sure exactly how many were really killed. And then you get the lie that, oh, the 40 children. Okay, well, what are their names? You know, grandparents love grandchildren, so I'd like to see all the grieving grandparents who lost the grandchildren that day. They haven't published it. They haven't put out the names. That tells you it's propaganda, that it's not true. Because I guarantee you, you know, if you killed my infant son and I survived, you'd be hearing about it that very day. You'd be carrying signs with the picture, the name, whatever, you know. You're not seeing that in Israel. You are seeing people carrying pictures of the hostages. So that's why I say this, Israel itself, the Zionist government, is a terrorist government. There's no other way to look at it.
And the hatred that they're producing right now, it's unbelievable. And I don't know how many years we need that to bring some sort of peace in that region. How do you see the situation with Hezbollah right now?
Well, Hezbollah is just, you know, they're continuing to fire rockets and missiles into Israel. They've depopulated the northern part of Israel. And the Israelis keep talking about they're going to attack them. But, you know, that was the Israeli chief of staff made that threat in January. Well, here we are, you know, 6 months later, Israel's still not doing it because they don't have the ability. They don't have the force structure to do it yet. In fact, they don't have the force structure to do it and succeed, is what I mean. That, yeah, they can invade, they can go in, they can take some territory initially, but they're going to get chewed up. Hezbollah is a much more formidable military force than anything that Hamas. Hamas is a guerrilla force. They are launching, you know, ambushes, and you know, they can't mass troops, can't mass fire. Hezbollah can. So it's important to understand that Hezbollah is not just some creature of Iran. You know, when Hezbollah started off, yeah, it was relying heavily on support from Iran, but that's changed over the years. Hezbollah has become its own entity, has its own army, has it's a political, social, it's a government. It really is. It's a government inside the government of Lebanon. And it's, you know, the Israelis, I don't know if they know that and they just refuse to acknowledge it in public or that they really don't understand that. But the ultimate, you know, I think the ultimate peace, if it could be achieved, and I don't think it's possible, but the path would be go back to the 67 borders. That means you uproot all of the settlers in the West Bank that have stolen land from the Palestinians, force them out, get them back in their own territory, and then get a rock solid guarantee of border security, both for Israel and as well as for the Palestinians. It's noteworthy that the initial declaration that Hamas put out when it was formed in 1987? Yeah, called for the elimination of the Jews. Well, when they did revised it and reissued it, that went away. They recognized that their battle was not against Jews, but against the Zionists. And they drew that distinction. So there is a path forward where you can find a compromise, but it's not going to come necessarily easily, and I'm doubtful that you can get the Israelis to agree to it. So they're going to have to fight it out. And the other reality here is Israel does not have the financial and physical resources, I'm talking about its own source of oil, as well as manpower, to sustain long-term combat. And Hamas has drugged this out now for 6 months without an organized army, and Israel hasn't been able to stop it. And they keep, they just withdrew from the Jabalia refugee camp today or yesterday. Well, Hamas or the PIJ, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, they're going to be back in there today, tomorrow. So, Israel keeps taking territory and then it keeps getting taken back. And it's a little bit, it's like a guerrilla war. And, Israel's only option is to kill all the Palestinians. Now, they're happy to do that, except they're catching a lot of blowback now over this murder that they did the other day in Rafah. We could be reaching the point where we could see Israel then removed from the United Nations as a sanction. The ICC arrest warrants, I don't put a lot of stock in those. It's good theater, bad messaging for the Israelis. They get to portray themselves as the victims. The ICJ decisions are much more formidable in terms of its weight. The Security Council will not take action because it'll be blocked by the United States. But it still leaves open, as we talked about, the fact that on the floor of the General Assembly could move to expel Israel from participating in the General Assembly. That could happen. So again, Israel's isolated, and the United States is becoming more isolated. We don't see countries lining up saying, "Oh, hey, Joe Biden, we're with you, man. We got you all the way." Just the opposite.
Yeah, you look at the Middle East, you look at Africa, you look at Europe, in each and every part of this world, their policy is failing and failing totally.
Yeah, yeah. They talked about that book, how to make friends and influence people. It's called diplomacy. You've had several comments by African leaders over the last week. I've seen two different ones. And they talk about the difference in, they said, when we deal with the Russians don't show up and say, "Okay, let us tell you what you need to do here. Let's say here's what you need to fix. This is wrong here." The Russians come in and they talk to them. I don't know if you've ever had the kind of friend that they show up at your house, they walk in and say, "Man, Nima, you look terrible. Why are you so fat? Why your clothes sort of suck too, man. You're out of style." So everything they got to say to you is critical. And you feel like you're being attacked. That's the United States. As opposed to somebody shows up and says, "Hey, Nima, man, hey, how are you? Good to see you again. You're looking great." Just the difference in those kinds of interpersonal reactions. Same thing happens with nation states. And the Russians treat these other countries with respect. And people detect when you're, when you're bullshitting them, when you're not giving genuine respect, and when you're actually saying, "No, I respect you for what you do, for how you talk, what you think, et cetera.
Yeah.